Stay tuned for the best radio talk show on Arab and American issues.
The Lady.
Good morning and thank you for being with us. Welcome to US Arab Radio. This is Khalil Hashim with the Local Connections. Thank you for being with us. We have a great program for you today. This week, America is celebrating its independence. This is the holiday that has become synonymous with barbecue and fireworks. This year, we wanted to explain to our community what the holiday is all about and what is it about and how it came about as well. With us this morning is Dr. Hal Friedman. He's a professor of history at Henry Ford College. Dr. Friedman, good morning and thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. We appreciate it. So what is 4th of July?
Well, I'm not sure that the answer is going to satisfy your listeners if they're asking what is the 4th of July, because like a lot of other things in American society and culture, the 4th of July, I think, is to some extent what we make it. There are obviously some basic ingredients to the holiday. Flying the flag outside the house is an old tradition. Attending a parade, especially if you're in the military or have a relative in the military, or as I used to do years ago, if you have a child, a son in my case, who is in a school band, they are in a parade. Barbecues, concerts, like the televised concerts on PBS every year. Those have become traditions in the 20th century with radio and film and TV. But I think the barbecues probably became a tradition in the 20th century because barbecue, of course, was an old American Indian cooking tradition that turned into an American Southern tradition, and then gradually by the 1900s became national. So I don't think the founding fathers were barbecuing, but certainly parades, toasts, picnics, those kinds of activities were very early on. But to some extent, you know, like a lot of our holidays and a lot of our traditions, given that we are an immigrant society going back 400 years, really, the 4th of July, to some extent, is what you make it. Your particular group, your particular, even sometimes individual tastes. I don't know if your listeners have ever seen or watched the old Magnum PI series from the 1980s with Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
And if you'll remember, in that series, Magnum spends the 4th of July alone every single year kayaking.
Yes.
Why? Because his father was killed on July 4th, 1951, shot down over North Korea. And so that's how he winds up spending his holiday. Now, we don't know how many individuals do things like that, because when they do things as individuals, they're just alone. But I think the 4th of July, to some extent, is what your individual tastes, what your family, what your community or neighborhood, and maybe even what your immigrant group or your ethnic group or racial group, or sometimes even generation makes it. My wife and I spent many 4ths of July with a cousin of mine, and she and her husband lived on White Lake in Oakland County. And of course, what are people doing on lakes? There are dozens and dozens and dozens of boats out on lakes, not to mention the fireworks. Sometimes they're foolishly drinking while they're on their boats. Or as my son said when he was about 9 years old, "Wow, Dad, those teenagers are sure having a good time on that boat." And yes, they were. So I think the 4th of July, you know, basically being, you know, a federal and national holiday is what you make of it. Of course, I'm sure it's changed. I can't confirm this, but I'm guessing that in the 1700s and 1800s and probably even before World War II, if able to, people took the day off. I doubt they had the long weekends like we're probably going to have with this one. I mean,
this year,
this one's on a Thursday. I'm assuming that every kind of like a mini holiday season in December, everything's going to, I think, shut down for about 4 days. And if you're interested in getting work done, you're probably going to be pretty frustrated.
Exactly.
This weekend. And I would imagine next year it'll be on a be on a Friday. So again, we'll have kind of a long weekend. And a long weekend, of course, is really a post-World War II kind of phenomenon that was created. I don't think people had long weekends on farms or when they worked in factories and before labor unions created holidays and things like that. Some myths of the 4th of July. The document was actually approved by the Continental Congress on July 2nd. So John Adams just assumed that July 2nd would become the national holiday. It wound up becoming July 4th because the document wasn't fully edited until July 4th. And the July 2nd approval was after, I think, the Continental Congress made something like 85 revisions to Jefferson's original manuscript. I think he was actually quite insulted that they had scribbled everything out and written in margins and changed all kinds of things. So the document went through quite a process. And most signers did not sign it until early August. And I'm not sure what that delay is. There was some delay in getting members of Continental Congress to Philadelphia by that summer, because of course they had to travel from all over at a time when you could cover maybe about 25 miles a day on horseback or carriage. But they were obviously all there by June or early July. But they didn't sign it until early August. So if you look at, I think it's Jonathan Trumbull's portrait of the signers all together in Independence Hall signing the document all on July 4th, the painting's rather mythical. I think they signed it in August as they managed to make their way into Independence Hall to sign the document. I don't think they were all grouped together all at the same time. And interestingly enough, July 4th didn't become the holiday until 1870. So it took Congress some time to pass an act to make it a law. It reminds me of the story of the Star Spangled Banner, which was created in 1814. But and I was rather shocked when I found this out. Congress did not make it the national anthem until 1931.
Wow.
And I had no idea it was that late in our history.
Wow.
I just assumed it became the national anthem in 1814. So these holidays, you know, kind of progress and evolve.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's a good lesson, not only for your listeners, but I think for Americans in general. These documents that we created, like the Declaration of Independence, like the U.S. Constitution, I mean, there's an old debate about to what extent we should literally read these documents or take into account our own time period. And I think it's a really significant lesson that the Founding Fathers never assumed us to interpret these documents as written in stone and unchangeable. They assumed that our interpretation of these documents, who's included in the clubhouse, who can vote, who's considered an American, these things were going to change. In fact, the Founding Fathers even thought there needed to be another constitutional convention probably about 50 years after theirs, because they assumed that the country would change so much that the Constitution wouldn't be an effective way of managing the country. They assumed there had to be an entirely new document. Yeah. So it's rather a myth that they thought that this was an unchangeable document that could never be transformed. So when we read, you know, all men are created equal, I think it's fair to say, I hope the majority of the American population now reads that as all people are created equal.
All people, exactly. Men as in people. It's not men as
people in general.
Yeah. I mean, this is really what's really unique about America is that everything has evolved into what we have today, you know, which is really important. So do we know when fireworks became part of this holiday?
Oh, I don't offhand, but I would guess probably late 1700s.
Yeah.
Because I think the technology was still around. If one of the listeners has more up-to-date information, then hopefully they can email it in.
Sure.
But I would imagine late 1700s. John Adams talked on July 2nd about the day being marked by fireworks. So I would imagine it's something that, in addition to picnics and everything else, I would imagine it came in fairly early. I'm sure they didn't have the pyrotechnics that we have today.
Sure.
Especially the computer controlled.
Yes.
Fireworks displays like we can probably see on PBS this weekend, or in our own communities. But I would imagine that was one of the early major aspects of the holiday.
Let's back up a little bit and
sure.
So why did white Europeans come to the New World?
Well, they really came as agents of empire. I mean, they really came as Europeans really came as agents of their monarchs, who were constantly engaged in contests of power in the Old World. And they were constantly seeking to find new sources of things that they could exploit: gold, silver, diamonds, spices. They were in an economic system that the different monarchies called mercantilism, where they were in strategic competition with each other. And so the monarch who controlled the greater sources of raw materials and economic products could obviously have a stronger economy. And if you have a stronger economy, you have a stronger monarchy and empire. You have a bigger military, you have more diplomatic leverage in the world. And so it actually became, I mean, Columbus was searching for China.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And people in the Old World did not know that the Western Hemisphere existed. They knew the world was round. Arab and Muslim scholars had fully mm-hmm. determined that in the mm-hmm. Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they also didn't know the Western Hemisphere existed. So they took the Earth to be 17,000 miles around in circumference, mm-hmm. which is about 8,000 miles off. And if you stick the Western Hemisphere in, then you get the 25,000. So Columbus thought he was headed for China and what the Europeans called the East Indies, and he smacked into the Caribbean islands. And once the European monarchs understood that there was an entirely new hemisphere, there's an entirely new set of territories to be conquered and settled and exploited, then you start having the contests between the different colonial powers for the conquest of the Americas. And you start bringing in, you start enslaving American Indians to exploit things in Central and South America like gold and silver. But then you start bringing in African slaves, to exploit things in North America where there's no gold or silver, but you can grow things like cotton and indigo and things like that. This all becomes sources of profit, obviously, for merchants, but that all gets funneled into the strategic calculus of power competition by the monarchs. If your merchants can corner the market on particular products, you as the monarch will corner the market by taxing them.
Sure.
And you transfer your tax revenue into bigger armies, bigger navies, and the conquest of more territory.
So coming here basically was part of colonial project, basically.
Yeah,
very much so. Americans came to the to this North America.
Yeah. Yes. It depended on who you were talking to. For the monarchs, it's colonial competition.
Yes.
For the merchants, it's about profit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For individuals, it's about getting out of or getting away from whatever situation in the Old World
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
was harming them or not satisfying them.
Mm-hmm.
It was very difficult in Old Europe, for instance, and I would imagine this might have been the case in the Middle East or in Asia, other parts of Asia. It was very difficult in Europe for individuals to own land if they were commoners,
mm-hmm,
if they weren't
mm-hmm.
aristocrats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's North America?
Yeah.
It's huge. I mean, the current state of Texas is the size of the entire nation of France.
That's true.
So if you're a land-starved European, you probably don't think you're coming to the colonies or the United States as part of an agent of an empire. You are probably coming to get land which you can't obtain in Europe. With early Arab immigrants in the late 1800s, there was really grinding poverty in Syria, where they mainly came from, present-day area of Lebanon. And what did they know about? They knew about this place over the horizon where the streets were supposedly paved with gold. So I'll head to North America. My paternal grandfather came in 1900 for a very different reason. He was a Lithuanian Jew who had gotten his draft notice from the Imperial Russian Army. The Imperial Russian Army had a policy for sending Jewish recruits to Siberia. And Reuben Friedlander was a 20-year-old, and I guess he wanted to make it to 21 or 25. And so he bribed his way out of the Russian Empire into the German Empire and then caught a ship in Danzig for New York City. People have, and that, by the way, was a very common reason for European men coming to the United States in the 1800s. They were avoiding military drafts in their country. For people from the Middle East, I think it was primarily economic.
To a great extent,
merchants.
Later on, some conflicts, as you well know, but early on, economics and just things were not going well overseas. And their families are here and they're doing well and they're thriving. Yeah. So this is why they came. From, as you well know, from Iraq, some of the earlier Chaldeans, they came here for economics. Other Iraqis came here because of the conflict. So,
Early on, it was usually a male merchant coming over and once settled and established, bring the family over and then the extended families.
What we're going to do is, Dr. Friedman, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
At Top Rehab Physical Therapy Clinic in Dearborn, we provide effective physical therapy sessions in order to limit pain and discomfort. Top Rehab provides physical therapy care for any diagnosis prescribed by a physician, and we regularly see and treat conditions such as stroke, TMJ, fibromyalgia, sciatica, joint pain, and more. We use a variety of pain management methods, including modalities, soft tissue mobilization, and therapeutic exercise. If you're in need of physical rehabilitation or physical therapy, get the highest quality health care at Top Rehab. Most insurance is accepted and we're open Monday, Wednesday, and Friday 8 to 6, Tuesday and Thursday 8 to 5, and Saturday 10 till 2. Call for an appointment today at 313-846-0555. That's 313-846-0555. Choose Top Rehab Physical Therapy Clinic on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn. Life's too short to be in pain.
In a perfect world, everyone would be a perfect driver.
Hands at 9 and 3, everyone.
9 and 3.
Everyone would follow all the rules.
Please, go ahead and merge. I'll make room.
Thank you, fellow driver.
And nothing unexpected would ever happen. Even the squirrels would know the right time to safely cross the road. In this perfect world, you wouldn't have to wear a seatbelt. But in case you hadn't noticed, we don't live in a perfect world. About 1,000 people in Michigan die each year in vehicle crashes, and thousands more are injured. Wearing your seatbelt reduces your risk of death in a crash by 45% in a car and by 60% in a pickup truck. So until we find a perfect world to drive in, make our imperfect world safer by buckling up. A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.
Life for Relief and Development has now been rated as one of the best charities for humanitarian aid. Life's humanitarian projects span the globe, and Life is celebrating its 30th anniversary of providing essential life-saving aid to people and communities in 36 countries, regardless of race, color, religion, or cultural background. Where there is life, there is hope. And when disaster occurs here or around the world, including being one of the first responders to the Turkey-Syria earthquake crisis, Life for Relief and Development rushes in to provide food, medical aid, and shelter to those in need. We are looking to help the earthquake victims, and we take 0% overhead on emergency donations. So please help improve these efforts. Learn more about our involvement to help the helpless and bring hope where it's needed most, and make your tax-deductible donation to Life for Relief and Development now at lifeusa.org or call 248-424-7493. That's 248-424-7493.
Are you going to start a restaurant or a grocery store soon? Do you need floor plans and designs? Call Naji Abood at 734-744-9796. Do you want to buy kitchen and restaurant equipment at discount prices? Call Naji Abood now, 734-744-9796. New Concept Products and Design, the trademark of kitchen equipment. 5% discount on all purchases of $75,000 or more. New Concept Products and Design, new location, 31185 Schoolcraft in Livonia. Learn more at www.newconceptproducts.com. Call Naji Abood, 734-744-9796.
Welcome back and thank you for being with us. We're talking to Dr. Friedman about 4th of July and what it means. So when, historically, when did these white Europeans start having problems with natives? I mean, historically people say they discovered America. America was already, there were already people living here.
Yeah.
It's not like they discovered land that was nobody is living. There were people living here. You know, there were, you know, some studies I've seen, you know, millions and millions of Native Americans here.
Yeah.
When did they start really having problems with Native Americans? I think at the beginning, if I'm not mistaken, they had really good relations and then things didn't go well.
It depended on which European powers, colonists you were talking about. Conflict started very early between the Indian tribes or the Indian communities, really usually towns or villages, and the Spanish conquistadors, because the Spanish conquistadors were particularly aggressive with searching for El Dorado. Where is the city where the streets are paved with gold? Spanish were particularly aggressive about trying to convert the Indians to Christianity. So the conflict started very early on. With other groups, you see conflicts early on, but it depends on the imperial power you're talking about. There is some cooperation between the English and the Indian tribes in and around the Chesapeake Bay area of Virginia, for instance. Because frankly, the English needed them. They didn't know how to farm early on in North America, and they were starving to death. They were extraordinarily dependent on Indian corn. But as soon as the English in those areas obtained enough people and therefore power, then you start seeing conflicts over land acquisition. There were early conflicts between the French and the Algonquian tribes in the St. Lawrence River Valley. But after several decades, it settled down into the French probably having the best relations with the North American Indian tribes of any European colonial power. Now, why was that? Because New France was outnumbered 10-1 by the English colonies, and the French needed the Indians as diplomatic and military allies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So maybe still no great love lost between the two groups, but strategic need. And very often when groups of Indians or tribes of Indians, or even sometimes they called themselves or were labeled nations by the Europeans, when they had good diplomatic relations with a European power, it was because they were obtaining something, usually technology, firearms, or other kinds of metal implements, because the North American Indians could not make metal implements on their own, other than the Indians in the UP of Michigan who had somehow mastered making copper.
Copper, yes, yes.
Important to understand, though, that strategic competition in North America was rife between the Indian groups as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sometimes in a way that's really typical in international relations that we don't hear about. In 1742, the Six Nations of the Iroquois which was an extraordinarily powerful group, were tired of English settlers traipsing over their territory. They signed a treaty with the British Empire, handing over Shawnee and Delaware land to the British Empire, mm-hmm. without the Shawnee or the Delaware ever being consulted about the matter at all.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a secret deal. So while, you know, I think in schools and even in colleges, we focus on the really horrible relations that were created between groups of Europeans and political entities of Indians, and we shouldn't ignore those. We should also understand that there were very often really, really bitter conflicts between different Indian political entities as well.
Now, the reason we call him Indian is because Christopher Columbus thought he was coming to India.
Right, right.
Okay.
And I, in my classrooms, I don't use the words indigenous or native because, frankly, indigenous means you've been here since the beginning of time, and no one's been here since the beginning of time. The various Indian groups came here somewhere between 20 to 30,000 years ago, as far as we can tell with archaeology. Native is more a 20th century creation. And actually, when I'm teaching early American history, I try to identify the particular Indian group I'm talking about by tribal designation or ethnic designation, because Indian groups usually come down through ethnic groupings. Or maybe later political designations, the Six Nations of the Iroquois, for instance. That way, I think my students have a better idea of who we're talking about. I mean, calling someone American Indian, even though I use the phrase a lot in my classrooms, is about as overgeneralized as calling someone a European,
sure,
or an Asian or an African. So I introduce these terms to my students, But I try to get them into as many specifics as we can in, say, 16 weeks of a semester.
Yeah. So over the years, Europeans that came here decided to create colonies. And
yeah,
I think it was 13 colonies, if I'm not mistaken.
The British did.
Yeah, the British did. Yeah. And then these colonies were like specific territories divided into. I mean, people did really people know where the areas are and everything? Like states?
No,
like today?
The geography was a little fuzzy.
Okay.
And in fact, you know, the textbook publishers are starting to get away from this, fortunately. But I think we're probably all familiar with those early American maps in textbooks that showed the really clear boundaries of the 13 colonies versus New France, or New Netherlands or New Spain. And in fact, if you look at a map of North America anywhere from the 1500s to about 1815, understand that the vast majority of North America was controlled by various Indian groups. Some of them very large and powerful. I mean, the Dakota Sioux Indians on the Northern Plains were a huge empire. And there were others like that. I started using textbooks and in the old days, the 1990s, overhead transparencies from those textbooks, because some of them started coloring in where the actual European and European American settlements were. And if you look at a map of North America up to, say, 1750, they're basically no further west than the Appalachian Mountain Range. If you look at a map of 1815, they're just starting to reach into what's today the American Midwest. The rest of the continent, with a few exceptions here and there, is Indian controlled. And so what we're talking about, if we're talking about the colonial period of North American history being, say, the 1500s to the 1800s, the various groups of Indians don't really start losing territorial control until the early to mid 1800s. And a lot of that's diseases, because diseases kill off about, depending on the time period and the portion, about 40 to 60% of the original populations, Indian populations in North America. And it's, I don't consider this a genocide. I don't consider it biological warfare, because the Europeans don't know much more about diseases than the Indians do. But it winds up being a sort of byproduct strategic weapon, because if the Indian tribes are your enemies in conquering North America, and 40 to 60% of them are gone, you have a tremendous advantage, especially the populations of these European colonies in the early United States are going up and up and up and up and up. There's immigration. There's also incredible birth rates. I mean, the 13 colonies have a population of 2.5 million in 1775. the early United States has a population of 5 million in 1800 and then 10 million in 1820. So it's doubling about every generation from a combination of high birth rate, longer lifespan than in the old world, and immigration. There's an estimated 5 million Indians in North America in 1500, but there's only an estimated 1 million by 1800.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at territorial conquest and settlement, and you're a European power or the early United States, this is a tremendous advantage to you,
advantage,
and a
yeah,
tremendous disadvantage
yeah.
if you're an Indian tribe.
Yeah. We're going to take another break. Please stay tuned.
Get ready for an amazing experience at Ishtar Restaurant on 15 Mile Road in Sterling Heights. Enjoy excellent hospitality from owners Ali Abagdadi and Fatty Bottom, serving the best in Mediterranean food. Try Chef Ali Abagdadi's famous shawarma, the best Iraqi grills and food, and the best Arabic and international dishes. Dine in our authentic atmosphere or take out. Call 586-698-2585 or check us out on Facebook. Ishtar Restaurant practices all CDC guidelines and is open every day 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Have an amazing experience today at Ishtar Restaurant, 3625 15 Mile Road, Sterling Heights. With more than 30,000 successful in vitro fertilizations, IVF Michigan is now ranked as one of America's best fertility clinics, according to Newsweek magazine. IVF Michigan fertility centers are the recognized leaders in high-quality fertility care. With locations in Bloomfield Hills and 9 other cities in Michigan and Ohio, IVF has experts in all aspects of the field. A founding member, American Board Certified Dr. Nicholas Shama, is one of the leading reproductive endocrinologists in Michigan and Ohio. He has performed over 20,000 successful IVF cases, and it's helped thousands of couples fulfill their dreams of parenthood. When it's time to get personalized care from Dr. Nicholas Shama at one of America's best fertility clinics, call IVF Michigan Fertility Centers in Michigan and Ohio toll-free at 855-952-9600. 855-952-9600.
What's my ETA?
Your estimated time of arrival is 9:17.
I'm late. I'll have to punch it.
Speeding will save you just 1 minute and 36 seconds. It will also increase your risk of a crash, as well as the odds that you will be stopped and issued an expensive speeding ticket.
Yeah, but...
In 1 year, there were 22,000 speeding-related crashes in Michigan, resulting in 200 deaths.
If I had someone in the car with me, I'd drive slower. But it's just me.
This is not a logical response. Though you have no passenger, surrounding cars contain 27 others, including 5 children and 1 Labrador Retriever.
How do you know all this stuff?
I know everything, Kevin.
Your risk of a crash increases with every mile you drive over the speed limit. So slow down. Speed enforcement is happening now. A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.
Ziad Brand. Quality products from our family to yours. Ziad Brothers Importing offers the finest quality products, including brands like Sultan, Kraft, Nestle, Hook, Rico Picon, Donna, and many more. Ask your retailer to carry these fine products because you deserve the very best. For more information, visit our website at www.ziad.com. That's www.ziad.com. Ziad, quality products from our family to yours.
Hey, Michigan drivers. Are you sending or answering group chats behind the wheel? Checking emails at the light? Calling family or friends on the commute? Michigan's hands-free law makes it illegal to manually use electronic devices while behind the wheel of a vehicle. Breaking the law could mean fines or even community service. Go hands-free. Just drive. It's the law. Learn more at michigan.gov/distracteddriving. A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.
Welcome back, and thank you for being with us. We're talking to Dr. Friedman about the history of the 4th of July and talking a little bit more, reaching back a little bit about American history. Since everything was working for them, and that's white European, why did they decide to separate from the monarch in specifically England? And did they really fight the battle with them?
Well, it's the causes of the American Revolution are still being debated. The argument I always made to my students is that both the British and the colonists began to have misperceptions about each other, which as a historian of international relations, I think is probably the most basic cause for wars between nations and groups.
Sure.
The British had, and their colonists had defeated the French Empire in what was called the Seven Years or the French and Indian War. And the British had acquired control over the St. Lawrence River Valley and all the French forts in the Mississippi River and Great Lakes region. The various Indian tribes were still in control of the rest of what the French had been claiming as their empire. But the British suddenly had a really vast new set of territories to govern. And they also had an incredible debt from the war. They had doubled their national debt. And British taxpayers paid really high taxes in the 1700s. British colonists paid next to nothing in taxes. And so the British Parliament thought about raising some taxes. And contrary to our national mythology, these were not onerous taxes. They would not have ruined the colonists. But what angered the colonists wasn't so much the taxes or the rate of taxation. It was the fact that Parliament could make laws without the colonists having any say in the lawmaking. Or the policy process, or the management or administration of the laws. The British, on the other hand, once the colonists started resisting the laws based on this political idea, the British Empire did what empires do. They tried to assert their authority. How dare the colonists protest Parliament? Parliament's Parliament makes laws for the empire. And everything that Parliament or the colonists did on the one hand or the other in the 1760s and 70s looked to the other side worse than the intention really was. What do the colonists want? They really don't want independence. They do not want to break away from the British Empire, but they want representation in Parliament.
In the British Parliament.
The British Parliament. That's right. Each of the 13 colonies had their own parliament. Yeah. They want representation in the British Parliament. British Parliament thinks that's absolutely ridiculous. Colonies do not make laws for the empire. The empire makes laws for the empire. And so, you know, how do the British react to the protesting? Well, you send redcoats to Boston to police the population where most of the protests are. Well, the redcoats are seen as agents of empire and to be resisted. And so you have the Boston Massacre. And every time one side or the other ups the ante, the other side thinks the absolute worst about the other side. And as I tell my students, those of whom are old enough to have watched Star Trek, since each side can't Vulcan mind meld with each other, and you think the worst about the other side, you prepare for the worst. Yes. Well, if you prepare for the worst, the other side thinks the worst is going to happen. And before you know it, you've got colonial militia exchanging live rounds with British redcoats at Lexington and Concord. But it is important to understand that most colonists, right up until about probably 1773, 1774, do not want to break away from the empire. They are very proud in the 1760s to be part of the British Empire and to call themselves British. And Paul Revere on his famous ride does not go through the countryside saying the British are coming, the British are coming, because the colonists identified themselves as British and they wouldn't have known what the hell he's talking about. Exactly. He said the redcoats are coming. That's what made sense. Yeah. Also, I think it's important for the listeners to understand the American Revolution was not one big tax revolt. Again, the taxes only came into play because there were laws that Parliament was trying to impose on the colonies. That's what it was about. It was a political fight over power.
Sure.
More than anything.
Yeah. And then finally decided, okay, it's time to declare independence from the, you know.
Yes. And it took a couple of British actions. the British colonial governor of Virginia, a military officer named Lord Dunmore, made, shall we say, a strategic miscalculation. He decided to put out a proclamation in 1775 that if Africans and African Americans who were enslaved would come to fight for the British against the rebelling colonies, they would obtain freedom. Now, during the War of American Independence, the British sometimes gave people of color who fought for them freedom, sometimes didn't. This was a proclamation that Dunmore put out. And the American Southern colonies, which had large numbers of slaves, took this to be particularly dangerous. North Carolina, for instance, had a 90% black population, the vast, vast majority of whom were slaves. So if your slaves are fighting for the British, you are not only going to lose property as an individual, you're probably going to lose that portion of the colonies to mm-hmm. the British because of the large black population. And the British Empire is also has forged strong diplomatic ties with American Indian tribes, because colonial Americans want Indian land, but the British Empire doesn't want Indian land, not directly. The British start hiring German mercenaries called Hessians to supplement their army. They not only send a fleet with an army to North America to quell Boston and try to quell the rebellion, but the king and parliament are hiring German mercenaries who the colonists think are going to do the worst possible things to them if they come to the 13 colonies. Actually, most of the German mercenary soldiers who came and fought in the American Revolution and survived, a huge numbers of them stayed in the early United States, became American citizens. Their families are still here. But the fear in 1775 was, oh no, German mercenaries mm-hmm. are coming to get us. And there became a really, really quick rage against George III and Parliament over things like Lord Dunmore's proclamation and the German mercenaries and the British Navy and Army being sent to North America. This is all still being explored. It's very, very complex and very, very difficult to figure out. But if King George III is the head of the British family, i.e. the British Empire, and you as colonists are part of the British Empire, King George III is your political father. Fathers aren't supposed to abuse their children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if the king is sending soldiers and German mercenaries and a fleet and blockading harbors and allowing Lord Dunmore to make his proclamation and cutting diplomatic deals with Indian tribes, then he must not be a very good father. And what do you do with a bad father? At least before the age of retirement homes, when you can stick them in a bad retirement home, you rebel.
And against them, yeah. Yeah.
Really quickly in 1774, 1775, there is this idea of rebelling against the king, pulling down his statues that are in the colonial capitals and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
No, obviously no longer celebrating his birthday as a national holiday. In fact, why do you have Independence Day? It's the replacement for celebrating the monarch's birthday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was the British national holiday.
Yeah.
And historians are still researching and writing and exploring, wondering, why does this happen so quickly in 1774, 1775? I really don't have a good answer for that one. It's just one of those phenomena that we're still exploring.
Was there like a specific battle in which England lost and it was like, okay, that's over, and then the colonies succeeded?
Oh. Well, the Battle of Yorktown in 1781 is usually designated as such because an entire British army of about, I think, 7,000 men, about a quarter of all the British troops in North America had to surrender to George Washington and General Rochambeau of the French army. And when you lose a quarter of your army, even though they're still alive and they're prisoners, you lose a quarter of your army, you have to start thinking about peace negotiations. And that's the point where Parliament decided, okay, we'll start negotiating with they're still calling them the 13 colonies. The Americans are calling themselves the United States. But Parliament decides, okay, we've been at this for over six years. It's gone nowhere. We've spent all this money, lost all these lives. I guess we're going to have to cut the colonies loose. But it's important to understand that Yorktown was in October 1781. The treaty ending the war wasn't until April 1783. So there was another year and a half of fighting that continued, especially guerrilla-like fighting between different groups of Americans, because only about 40% of the American population were Continentals. About another 20% were loyalists. They stayed loyal to the British Empire.
British Empire, yeah.
And both of these groups were armed, mm-hmm. and they continued to fight each other in various actions throughout the Atlantic seaboard. By the way, that leaves about 40% of the American population, which was neutral. Mm-hmm. They never took sides in the American Revolution. They tried to stay out of the conflict. And until I think recent decades, I don't think we've done a very good job of teaching those percentages, because those mm-hmm. percentages are really important to keep in mind. Yes, this was a popular revolution, but it wasn't a 90 or 100% population popular revolution.
Yeah, that led to, you know, the British deciding it's over, and then the leaders decided we succeeded, and then right. they formed what we know today is the United States.
Yeah,
or the seed of what we know today is the United States.
It was the United States. I mean, we declare. I take the U.S. to be in existence as of July 2nd or July 4th, 1776. Mm-hmm. Whether mm-hmm. it's recognized as such by other countries. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you'll see a 20th century movie where someone from Britain arrives in the United States and, you know, well, how are things in the colonies these days? You know, well, it's, wait a minute, it's 1953. Let's get with it. But the Americans take themselves to be the U.S. I think from 1776 on, they don't get the UK to recognize them as such until the treaty in 1783. And then they start trying to establish diplomatic relations with various European powers as a way of getting those European powers to recognize them. But some of them did before. I mean, France recognizes an independent United States in 1778. The British, I think, probably, or the Dutch, I think, probably in the same year, if not before. It all depended on what your political interests were.
Sure.
If you're the British, you never really want to recognize the United States.
Yeah.
If you're the French and you're going to assist the United States because you hate the British, you're going to recognize the U.S. as soon as you know it's going to be around.
Yeah, competing.
The enemy of my enemy is my ally.
Yeah. And then from then on, you know, the United States developed into eventually what we have today. And
yeah.
Civil War and whatever, and then the defeat in what we have today, right? You know, right now,
growing population, and conquest of territory with that growing population, because in our first decades we had a pretty small army and a pretty small navy, and to some extent we conquered territory from the Indians by just avalanches of settlers going out. I mean, 95% of the early American population were farmers. And so what did they want? They wanted land. So rising population, greater territory, land, which was extraordinarily rich in water, in raw materials. So a phenomenal agricultural economy that eventually leads to a phenomenal industrial economy. And then from that industrial economy, once the Civil War is over with, and once the U.S. has conquered out to the West Coast, the idea of exporting American values overseas,
mm-hmm.
and at times conquering territory overseas, And sometimes these were for very laudable motives, and often they were for very greedy and selfish motives. And although Americans are really loath to call themselves an empire, historians have been calling the U.S. an empire for probably about the last 60 years. It's a different kind of empire. It becomes much more of a sort of
like a hegemon,
commercial empire than a territorial one. Although we do have territories in the Caribbean and the Pacific still. And I think to some extent in the 20th century, it becomes a cultural empire because the U.S.'s economy is so powerful and its political influence becomes so powerful. And even at times its material goods are so desired by people in other countries.
McDonald's.
The French, as early as the 1920s, complained that they were being invaded by the Americans. They did not mean soldiers. They did not mean colonial administrators. They meant Coca-Cola and hamburgers and clothing and jazz music and things like that.
Yeah. It's amazing how it really moved to what we have today.
As
you said, you know, Americans don't accept the fact that they're an imperial, you know, country, but the hegemony over, you know, different areas. How many? I mean, we have like 20 something bases overseas.
No, much more than that. We have several hundred. We actually have, I think, around 800 military installations. More than during the Cold War. Now, you know, the concept of empire is interesting. Before the U.S.'s disastrous invasion of Iraq in 2003, who would be using the word empire or imperial when it came to the United States? Well, historians did. Typically in 2000.
Some Russians.
Political scientists, probably some Russians, probably the Chinese.
Yeah.
I don't think Americans did in general, but, you know, after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and my conclusion here is more anecdotal than systematic. I haven't done systematic research in this, but I notice a lot of journalists and newspapers, news agencies, beginning to use the word empire and imperial when it came to, and even at times some government agencies. So I think small e empire or small I imperial has become a little more acceptable in American lexicon now in the wake of Afghanistan and Iraq than it was before. In 1995, I defended my dissertation at Michigan State, and I had the phrase U.S. imperialism in the subtitle of my dissertation. And my dissertation director took me aside and said, and jobs were not easy to get in academia then.
Sure.
I mean, a little easier than they are now. It's really difficult now, but not easy. And he took me aside and he said, are you sure you want that phrase in the subtitle of your dissertation? This could cost you a job. And I have to tell you from personal experience that when I interviewed with the history department at the U.S. Naval Academy, they weren't exactly enamored of my idea of labeling the U.S. an imperial power. In the 1940s. At Henry Ford Community College, I don't think they really cared. They just wanted to know that I was a good classroom teacher.
Sure.
And what I did for my scholarship was up to me. But it was, I think, until recently, sometimes even in academic circles, a rather controversial term to use. I think it's a little more acceptable now.
Why do you think they don't want to, a good number of Americans don't want to accept the fact that they are imperialist?
Yeah. Well, I think because we came from an empire and because we were colonists of an empire. And then you bring in some of the 4th of July mythology, okay, that we were abused and tyrannized by the British Empire. Well, we really weren't that badly abused and tyrannized by the British Empire until live shots were being fired. The taxes were not onerous. The laws were really not that onerous. And frankly, the British 13 colonies had the highest standard of living and the most political freedoms of anybody in the British Empire. But once you create the national mythology that we were tyrannized by an empire, and then you start becoming powerful enough to be an empire, which I would say is early 1800s, certainly by the 1840s, by the time we conquer half of Mexico from the Republic of Mexico. All right. But if you're the first republic in the modern world, the U.S., and you're conquering half of the territory of a sister republic, Mexico, you have to justify that somehow. And the way you do it is, well, we were victims. There's no way we could be victimizing people now. It's just not physically, you've got to get that out of your head. It's just not physically possible. And sure. I think that became the thinking for most of the rest of American history.
Yeah.
And obviously there were some people and some groups who didn't subscribe to that, but I think that became the general term. Even historians they had to be careful with using the term. There was a biographer of Thomas Jefferson in the 1920s who talked about the U.S. Louisiana Purchase being quote unquote protective imperialism, but that was really rare. That's the 1920s, really rare. You instead saw historians using phrases like expansionism. In the typical American textbook, well, the European settlers came to North America and they settled. Well, what exactly does that mean?
That's true.
If they're occupying somebody else's territory, yeah. You got to conquer somebody else's territory. Yeah. But we really rarely use the words conquer or imperial. We used words like settlement.
Absolutely.
Historians might still be subscribing to this a little bit. One of the major theses right now is the U.S. as a settler colonial nation. Well, what does settler colonialism mean? It really means imperialism, but they're not using the word imperialism. Yeah. There was one Canadian historian who wrote about U.S. Manifest Destiny being quote unquote defensive expansionism. Because from a U.S. perspective, when we move out into new territory, we're doing it for defensive purposes.
Exactly.
Unless you can sit in the other person's chair intellectually and realize, oh, wait a minute, this defensive action of ours might be really aggressive and offensive. But unless you can see the other side. And that's what I spent a lot of time in my classrooms trying to do. Okay, here's what's going on from a U.S. perspective. What's going on from a Shawnee perspective?
Yeah.
Or a Mexican perspective? Or a Guamanian perspective? Or, the current Cold War, and I do think we are in a Cold War with the People's Republic of China. And I move a lot in national security and military circles, and there's very much a sense of the U.S. is on the defensive when it comes to aggressive Chinese behavior in the Western Pacific. Now, I don't know this for sure because I'm not in Beijing. I can't mind meld with the Politburo, but I would guess in Beijing, the Politburo probably sees everything the U.S. is doing in the Western Pacific to counter their moves as aggressive and imperialistic.
Exactly.
I'm sure both sides.
Yeah.
And then you get into the miscommunication. Hopefully, in this case, the miscommunication doesn't lead to a shooting war because both the U.S. and the PRC have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
That's a big change since the original 4th of July.
we'll leave it to that since we're out of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully, those are the fireworks we'll never experience.
Exactly. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. This has been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope that we helped our community and everybody else who's listening to understand a little bit of the background of 4th of July and how we came up to that.
I hope so too. And again, you can celebrate it in a number of ways.
Yeah.
It's okay to have baklava at a 4th of July picnic if you don't want to have ice cream. I mean, that's cultural pluralism. It's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
So,
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Dr. Hal Friedman from Henry Ford College. Appreciate it.